place. Letting herself quietly out of the French windows into the courtyard behind the house, Robin used one of the garden chairs to clamber onto the top of the wall that divided their garden from that of the house directly behind them, of which the curtains were mercifully closed. With a muffled earthy thud, she slid off the wall onto the neighbour's lawn. The next part of her escape was a little trickier. She had first to drag a heavy ornamental bench in their neighbour's garden several feet, until it stood plumb with a fence. Then, balancing on the back of it, she climbed over the top of the creosoted panel, which swayed precariously as she dropped down into a flower bed on the other side, where she staggered and fell. Scrambling up again, she hurried across the new lawn to the opposite fence, in which there was a door to the car park on the other side. To Robin's relief, the bolt opened easily. As she pulled the garden gate closed behind her, she thought ruefully of the footprints she had just left across the dewy lawns. If the neighbours woke early, it would be only too easy to discover whence had come the intruder who had invaded their gardens, shifted their garden furniture, and squashed their begonias. Chisel's killer, if killer there was, had been far more adept at covering their tracks. Crouching down behind a parked Skoda in the deserted car park that served the garageless street, Robin used the wing mirror to adjust the dark wig she had taken out of her backpack, then walked off briskly along the street that ran parallel with Albury Street, until she turned right into Deptford High Street. Other than a couple of vans making early morning deliveries, and the proprietor of a newsagent raising the metal security roller door from his shop front, there was hardly anybody around. Glancing over her shoulder, Robin felt a sudden rush, not of panic, but of elation. Nobody was following her. Even so, she didn't remove her wig until she was safely on the tube, giving the young man who had been eyeing her covertly over his Kindle something of a surprise. Strike had chosen the corner cafe on Lambeth Road for its proximity to the forensics laboratory where Oliver Bargate worked. When Robin arrived, she found Strike standing outside smoking. His gaze fell to the muddy knees of her jeans. "Rough landing in a flowerbed," she explained, as she came within earshot. "That journalist is still hanging around."
"Matthew give you a leg up?"
"No, I use garden furniture." Strike ground out his cigarette on the wall beside him and followed her into the cafe, which smelled pleasantly of frying food. In Strike's opinion, Robin looked paler and thinner than usual, but her manner was cheerful as she ordered coffee and two bacon rolls.
"One," Strike corrected her. "One," he repeated regretfully to the man behind the counter. "Trying to lose weight," he told Robin, as they took a recently vacated table. "Better for my leg."
"Ah," said Robin. "Right."
As he swept the crumbs from the table with his sleeve, Strike reflected, not for the first time, that Robin was the only woman he had ever met who had shown no interest in improving him. He knew that he could have changed his mind now and ordered 5 bacon rolls, and she would simply have grinned and handed them over. This thought made him feel particularly affectionate towards her as she joined him at the table in her muddy jeans.
"Everything okay?" he asked, salivating as he watched her put ketchup on her roll.
"Yes," lied Robin. "All good."
"How's your leg?" "Better than it was." "What does this bloke we're meeting look like?"
"Tall, black, glasses," said Robin thickly, through a mouthful of bread and bacon. Her early morning activity had made her hungrier than she had been in days.
"Vanessa back on Olympics duty?"
"Yeah," said Robin. "She's badgered Oliver into meeting us. I don't think he was that keen, but she's after promotion."
"Dirt on Ian Nash will definitely help," said Strike. "From what Shankar told me, the Met's been trying—"
"I think this is him," whispered Robin.
Strike turned to see a lanky, worried-looking black man in rimless glasses standing in the doorway. He was holding a briefcase. Strike raised a hand in greeting, and Robin slid her sandwich and coffee over to the next seat to allow Oliver to sit opposite Strike. Robin was not sure what she had expected.
He was handsome, with his high-rise hairstyle and pristine white shirt, but seemed suspicious and disapproving, neither of which traits she associated with Vanessa. Nevertheless, he shook the hand Strike proffered, and, turning to Robin, said, "You're Robin. We've always missed each other."
"Yes," said Robin, shaking hands too.
Oliver's spotless appearance was making her feel self-conscious about her dishevelled hair and muddy jeans.
"Nice to meet you at last. It's counter service. Shall I get you a tea or coffee?"
"Coffee, yeah, that'd be good," said Oliver.
"Thanks."
As Robin went to the counter, Oliver turned back to Strike. "Vanessa says you've got some information for her."
"Might have," said Strike. "It all depends on what you've got for us, Oliver."
"I'd like to know exactly what you're offering before we take this any further."
Strike drew an envelope out of his jacket pocket and held it up.
"A car registration number and a hand-drawn map."
Apparently this meant something to Oliver.
"Can I ask you where you got this?"
"You can ask," said Strike cheerfully, "but that information's not included in the deal. Eric Wardle will tell you my contact's got a record of 100% reliability, though."
A group of workmen entered the cafe, talking loudly.
"This'll all be off the record," said Strike quietly. "No one'll ever know you talk to us."
Oliver sighed, then bent down, opened his briefcase, and extracted a large notebook. As Robin returned with a mug of coffee for Oliver and sat back down at the table, Strike readied himself to make notes.
"I've spoken to one of the guys on the team who did forensics," Oliver said, glancing at the workmen who were now bantering loudly at the next table,
"and Vanessa's had a word with someone who knows where the wider investigation's going." He addressed Robin.
"They don't know Vanessa is friendly with you. If it gets out that we helped, they won't hear it from us," Robin assured him.
Frowning slightly, Oliver opened his notebook and consulted the details he had jotted there in a small but legible hand.
"Well, forensics are fairly clear-cut. I don't know how much technical detail you want."
"Minimal," said Strike. "Give us the highlights."
Chisel had ingested around 500 milligrams of amitriptyline, dissolved in orange juice, on an empty stomach.
"That's a sizable dose, isn't it?" asked Strike.
"It could have been fatal on its own, even without the helium, but it wouldn't have been as quick. On the other hand, he had heart disease, which would have made him more susceptible. Amitriptyline causes dysrhythmia and cardiac arrest in overdose."
"Popular suicide method?"
"Yeah," said Oliver, "but it's not always as painless as people hope.
Most of it was still in his stomach, very small traces in the duodenum. Suffocation is what actually killed him, on analysis of the lung and brain tissue. Presumably the amitriptyline was a backup."
"Prints on the glass and the orange juice carton?"
Oliver turned a page in his notebook. "The glass only had Chisel's prints on it. They found the carton in the bin, empty, also with Chisel's prints on, and others. Nothing suspicious. Just as you'd expect if it had been handled during purchase. Juice inside tested negative for drugs. The drugs went directly into the glass."
"The helium canister?"
"That had Chisel's prints on it and some others. Nothing suspicious. Same as the juice carton, like it had been handled during purchase."
"Does amitriptyline have a taste?" asked Robin.
"Yeah, it's bitter," said Oliver.
"Olfactory dysfunction," Strike reminded Robin. "After the head injury, he might not have tasted it."
"Would it have made him groggy?" Robin asked Oliver.
"Probably, especially if he wasn't used to taking it. But people can have unexpected reactions. He might have become agitated."
"Any sign of how or where the pills were crushed up?" asked Strike.
"In the kitchen. There were traces of powder found on the pestle and mortar there."
"Prints?"
"His."
"Do you know whether they tested the homeopathic pills?" asked Robin.
"The what?" said Oliver.
"There was a tube of homeopathic pills on the floor. I trod on them," Robin explained. "Lachesis."
"I don't know anything about them," said Oliver.
and Robin felt a little foolish for mentioning them. There was a mark on the back of his left hand.
Yes, said Oliver, turning back to his notes. Abrasions to face and a small mark on the hand.
On the face, too, said Robin, freezing with her sandwich in her hand.
Yes, said Oliver.
Any explanation? Asked Strike.
You're wondering whether the bag was forced over his head, said Oliver. It was a statement, not a question. So did MI5. They know he didn't make the marks himself. Nothing under his own nails. On the other hand, there was no bruising to the body to show force. Nothing disarranged in the room. No signs of a struggle.
Other than the bent sword, said Strike.
I keep forgetting you were there, said Oliver.
You know all this.
Marks on the sword?
It had been cleaned recently, but Chisel's prints were on the handle.
What time of death are we looking at?
Between 6 and 7 a.m., said Oliver.
But he was fully dressed, mused Robin.
From what I've heard about him, he was quite literally the kind of bloke who wouldn't have been caught dead in pyjamas, said Oliver dryly.
Met's inclining to suicide, then? Asked Strike.
Off the record, I think an open verdict is quite likely. There are a few discrepancies that need explaining. You know about the open front door, of course. It's warped. It won't close unless you shut it with force, but it sometimes jumps back open again if you slam it too hard. So it could have been accidental, the fact that it was open. Chisel might not have realized he'd left it ajar, but equally, a killer might not have known the trick to closing it.
You don't happen to know how many keys to the door there were? Asked Strike.
No, said Oliver. As I'm sure you'll appreciate, Van and I had to sound only casually interested, asking all these questions.
He's a dead government minister, said Strike. Surely you didn't have to sound too casual.
I know one thing, said Oliver. He had plenty of reasons to kill himself.
Such as? Inquired Strike.
Pen paused over his notebook.
His wife was leaving him.
Allegedly, said Strike, writing.
They'd lost a baby, his eldest son died in Iraq. The family say he was acting strangely, drinking heavily and so on, and he had serious money problems.
Yeah, said Strike. Like what?
He was almost wiped out in the 2008 crash, said Oliver. And then there was, well, that business you two were investigating.
Do you know where the blackmailers were at the time of...
Oliver made a swift, convulsive movement that nearly knocked over his coffee.
Leaning toward Strike, he hissed.
There's a super injunction out, in case you haven't.
Yeah, we've heard, said Strike.
Well, I happen to like my job.
Okay, said Strike, unperturbed but lowering his voice. I'll rephrase my question. Have they looked into the movements of Geraint Wynne and Jimmy?
Yes, said Oliver curtly, and both have alibis.
What are they?
The former was in Bermondsey with...
Not Della, blurted Robin, before she could stop herself.
The idea of his blind wife being Geraint's alibi had struck her somehow as indecent. She had formed the impression, whether naively or not, that Della stood apart from Geraint's criminal activity.
No, said Oliver tersely.
And do we have to use names?
Who, then? Asked Strike.
Some employee. He claims he was with the employee and the bloke confirmed it.
Were there other witnesses?
I don't know, said Oliver, with a trace of frustration. I assume so. They're happy with the alibi.
What about Jip, the other man?
He was in East Ham with his girlfriend.
Was he? Said Strike, making a note of it. I saw him being marched off to a police van the night before Chisel died.
He was let off with a caution. But, Oliver said quietly, blackmailers don't generally kill their victims, do they?
Not if they're getting money out of them, said Strike,
still writing.
But Knight wasn't.
Oliver looked at his watch.
Couple more things, said Strike equably, his elbow still planted on the envelope containing Ian Nash's details. Does Vanessa know anything about a phone call to his son that Chisel made on the morning of his death?
Yes, she said something about that, said Oliver, flicking backwards and forwards through his notebook to find the information. Yeah, he made 2 calls just after 6 a.m., first to his wife, then to his son. Strike and Robin looked at each other again. We knew about the call to Raphael. He called his wife as well. Yeah, he called her first. Oliver seemed to read their reaction correctly, because he said, The wife's totally in the clear. She was the first person they investigated, once they were satisfied it wasn't politically motivated, obviously. A neighbour saw her go into the house on Ebury Street the evening before, and come out shortly afterwards with a bag 2 hours before her husband came back. A taxi driver picked her up halfway down the street and took her to Paddington. She was caught on camera on the train back to where she lives. Is it Oxfordshire? And apparently there was someone at the house when she got home, who can vouch for the fact that she arrived there before midnight and never left again until the police came round to tell her Chisel was dead. Multiple witnesses to her whole journey. Who was at the house with her? That I don't know. Oliver's eyes moved to the envelope still lying beneath Strike's elbow. And that really is everything I've got. Strike had asked everything he had wanted to know, and had gained a couple of bits of information he had not expected, including the abrasions to Chisel's face, his poor finances, and the phone call to Kinvara in the early morning. You've been a big help, he told Oliver, sliding the envelope across the table. Much appreciated. Oliver appeared relieved that the encounter was over. He stood up, and with one more hasty handshake and a nod to Robin, departed the café. Once Oliver had stridden out of sight, Robin sat back in her chair and sighed. "What's that glum expression for?" asked Strike, draining his mug of tea. "This is going to be the shortest job on record. Izzy wants us to prove it was Kinvara." "She wants the truth about her father's death," said Strike. But he grinned at Robin's sceptical expression. "And yeah, she's hoping it was Kinvara. Well, we'll have to see whether we can break all those alibis, won't we? I'm going to Woolstone on Saturday. Izzy's invited me over to Chisel House so I can meet her sister. Are you in? I'd rather not drive, the state my leg's in at the moment." "Yes, of course," said Robin immediately. The idea of getting out of London with Strike, even for a day, was so appealing that she did not bother to consider whether she and Matthew had plans. But surely, in the glow of their unexpected rapprochement, he would raise no difficulties. After all, she had not worked for a week and a half. "We can take the Land Rover. It'll be better on country roads than your BMW. "You might need diversionary tactics if that hack's still watching you," said Strike. "I think I could probably throw them off more easily in a car than on foot." "Yeah, you probably could," said Strike. Robin was in possession of an advanced driving qualification. Though he had never told her so, Robin was the only person by whom he would willingly be driven. "What time are we supposed to be at Chisel House?"
11, said Strike, "but plan to be away for the whole day. I fancy taking a look at the Knight's old place while we're there."
He hesitated.
"I can't remember whether I told you. I kept Barclay undercover with Jimmy and Flick."
He was braced for annoyance that he had not discussed it with her, resentment that Barclay had been working when she wasn't, or, perhaps more justifiably, a demand to know what he was playing at, given the state of the agency's finances. But she simply said, with more amusement than rancor, "You know you didn't tell me.
Why did you keep him there?"
"Because I've got a gut feeling there's a lot more to the Knight brothers than meets the eye."
"You always tell me to mistrust gut feelings."
"Never claim not to be a hypocrite, though." "Embrace yourself," Strike added, as they got up from the table. "Raphael's not happy with you."
"Why not?"
"Izzy says he fell for you. Quite upset you turned out to be an undercover detective."
"Oh," said Robin.
A faint pink blush spread over her face.
"Well, I'm sure he'll bounce back fast enough. He's that type."
Chapter 41. I was thinking of what brought us together from the first, what links us so closely to one another. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Strike had spent many hours of his life trying to guess what he had done to cause the sullen silence of a woman in his vicinity. The best that could be said for the prolonged sulk in which Lorelei spent most of Friday evening was that he knew exactly how he had offended her, and was even prepared to concede that her displeasure was, to some extent, justified. Within 5 minutes of his arrival at her flat in Camden, Izzy had called his mobile, partly to tell him about a letter that she had received from Geraint Wynne, but mainly, he knew, to talk. She was not the first of his clients to assume that they had purchased, along with detective services, a mixture of father-confessor and therapist. Izzy gave every sign that she was settling in to spend her entire Friday evening talking to Strike, and the flirtatiousness that had been apparent in the knee-touching of their last encounter was even more pronounced by phone. A tendency to size Strike up as a potential lover was not uncommon in the sometimes fragile and lonely women he dealt with in his professional life. He had never slept with a client in spite of occasional temptation. The agency meant too much to him, but even had Izzy held attraction for him, he would have been careful to keep his manner on the antiseptic side of professional, because she would be forever tainted in his mind by association with Charlotte. In spite of his genuine desire to cut the call short, Lorelei had cooked and was looking particularly lovely in a silky sapphire blue dress that resembled nightwear. Izzy had displayed the persistent adhesiveness of a teasel. It took Strike nearly 3/4 of an hour to disentangle himself from his client, who laughed long and loudly at even his mildest jokes, so that Lorelei could hardly fail to know that it was a woman who was at the other end of the line. Hardly had he got rid of Izzy and begun to explain to Lorelei that she was a grief-stricken client than Barclay had called with an update on Jimmy Knight. The mere fact that he had taken the second call, considerably briefer though it was, had, in Lorelei's eyes, compounded his original offence. This was the first time he and Lorelei had met since she had retracted her declaration of love. Her wounded and affronted demeanour over dinner confirmed him in the unwilling belief that, far from wanting their no-strings arrangement to continue, she had clung to the hope that if she stopped pressuring him, he would be free to reach the realization that he was, in fact, deeply in love with her. Talking on the phone for the best part of an hour, while dinner slowly shriveled in the oven, had dashed her hopes of a perfect evening and the reset of their relationship. Had Lorelei only accepted his sincere apology, he might have felt like sex. However, by 2:30 in the morning, at which time she finally burst into tears of mingled self-recrimination and self-justification, he was too tired and bad-tempered to accept physical overtures, which would, he feared, assume an importance in her mind that he did not want to give them. This had to end, he thought, as he rose, hollow-eyed and dark-jawed, at 6 o'clock, moving as quietly as possible in the hope that she would not wake before he made his way out of her flat. Foregoing breakfast, because Lorelei had replaced the kitchen door with an amusingly retro bead curtain that rattled loudly, Strike made it all the way to the top of the stairs to the street, before Lorelei emerged from the dark bedroom, sleep-tousled, sad and desirable in a short kimono.
"Weren't you even going to say goodbye?"
"Don't cry, please don't fucking cry."
"You looked very peaceful. I've got to go. Robin's picking me up at..."
"Ah," said Lorelei. "No, you wouldn't want to keep Robin hanging around."
"I'll call you," said Strike.
He thought he caught a sob as he reached the front door, but by making a noisy business of opening it, he could credibly claim not to have heard. Having left in plenty of time, Strike made a detour to a handy McDonald's for an Egg McMuffin and a large coffee, which he consumed at an unwiped table, surrounded by other early Saturday risers. A young man with a boil on the back of his neck was reading The Independent right ahead of Strike, who read the words, "Sports Minister in Marriage Split,
over the youth's shoulder before he turned a page. Drawing out his phone, Strike googled, "Win marriage." The news stories popped up immediately. Minister for Sport splits from husband, separation amicable. Della Wynne calls time on marriage. Blind Paralympics minister to divorce. The stories from major newspapers were all factual and on the short side, a few padded out with details of Della's impressive career within politics and outside. The press's lawyers would, of course, be particularly careful around the winds just now, with their super injunction still in place. Strike finished his McMuffin in two bites, jammed an unlit cigarette in his mouth, and limped out of the restaurant. Out on the pavement he lit up, then brought up the website of a well-known and scurrilous political blogger on his phone. The brief paragraph had been written only a few hours previously. Which creepy Westminster couple, known to share a predilection for youthful employees, are rumoured to be splitting at last? He is about to lose access to the nubile political wannabes on whom he has preyed so long, but she has already found a handsome young helper to ease the pain of separation. Less than 40 minutes later, Strike emerged from Baron's Court tube station to lean up against the pillar box in front of the entrance. Cutting a solitary figure beneath the Art Nouveau lettering and open-segmented pediment of the Grand Station behind him, he took out his phone again and continued to read about the Wynne separation. They had been married over 30 years. The only couple he knew who had been together that long were the aunt and uncle back in Cornwall, who had served as surrogate parents to Strike and his sister during those regular intervals when his mother had been unwilling or unable to care for them. A familiar roar and rattle made Strike look up. The ancient Land Rover that Robin had taken off her parents' hands was trundling towards him. The sight of Robin's bright gold head behind the wheel caught the tired and faintly depressed Strike off guard. He experienced a wave of unexpected happiness. "Morning," said Robin, thinking that Strike looked terrible as he opened the door and shoved in a hold-all. "Oh, sod off," she added, as a driver behind her slammed on his horn, aggravated by the time Strike was taking to get inside.
"Sorry, leg's giving me trouble. Dressed in a hurry."
"No problem."
"And you?"
Robin shouted at the driver, now overtaking them, who was gesticulating and mouthing obscenities at her. Finally dropping down into the passenger seat, Strike slammed the door, and Robin pulled away from the curb.
"Any trouble getting away?" he asked.
"What do you—"
"The journalist."
"Oh," she said. "No, he's gone. Given up." Strike wondered just how difficult Matthew had been about Robin giving up a Saturday for work.
"Heard about the Wynnes?" he asked her.
"No, what happened?"
"They've split up."
"No."
"Yep. In all the papers. Listen to this."
He read aloud the blind item on the political website.
"God," said Robin quietly. "I had a couple of interesting calls last night," Strike said, as they sped towards the M4.
"Who from?"
"One from Izzy, the other from Barclay. Izzy got a letter from Geraint yesterday," said Strike.
"Really?"
said Robin. "Yeah, it was sent to Chisel House a few days back, not her London flat, so she only opened it when she went back to Woolston. I got her to scan and email it to me. Want to hear?"
"Go on," said Robin.
"My very dear Isabella," ugh, said Robin, with a small shudder. "As I hope you will understand," read Strike, "Della and I did not feel it appropriate to contact you in the immediate shocking aftermath of your father's death. We do so now in a spirit of friendliness and compassion."
"If you need to point that out."
"Della and I may have had political and personal differences with Jasper, but I hope we never forgot that he was a family man, and we are aware that your personal loss will be severe. You ran his office with courtesy and efficiency, and our little corridor will be the poorer for your absence."
"He always cut Izzy dead," said Robin.
"Exactly what Izzy said on the phone last night," replied Strike. "Stand by, you're about to get a mention." I cannot believe that you had anything to do with the almost certainly illegal activities of the young woman calling herself Venetia. We feel it only fair to inform you that we are currently investigating the possibility that she may have accessed confidential data on the multiple occasions she entered this office without consent.
I never looked at anything except the plug socket, said Robin. And I didn't access the office on multiple occasions. Three. That's a few, at most.
As you know, the tragedy of suicide has touched our own family. We know that this will be an extremely difficult and painful time for you. Our families certainly seem fated to bump into each other in their darkest hours. Sending our very best wishes, our thoughts are with all of you, etc., etc.
Strike closed the letter on his phone. That's not a letter of condolence, said Robin.
Nope, it's a threat. If the Chisels blab about anything you found out about Geraint or the charity, he'll go after them, hard, using you.
She turned onto the motorway. When did you say the letter was sent?
5-6 days ago, said Strike, checking.
It doesn't sound as though he knew his marriage was over then, does it? All that our corridor will be poorer for your absence, Guff. He's lost his job if he's split with Della, surely.
You'd think so, agreed Strike. How handsome would you say Amir Malik is?
What? Said Robin, startled. Oh, the young helper. Well, he's okay-looking, but not model material.
It must be him. How many other young men's hands is she holding and calling darling?
I can't imagine him as a lover, said Robin.
A man of your habits, quoted Strike. Pity you can't remember what number that poem was.
Is there one about sleeping with an older woman?
The best-known ones are on that very subject, said Strike. Catullus was in love with an older woman.
Amir isn't in love, said Robin. You heard the tape.
He didn't sound smitten, I grant you. I wouldn't mind knowing what causes the animal noises he makes at night, though. The ones the neighbours complain about. His leg was throbbing. Reaching down to feel the join between prosthesis and stump, he knew that part of the problem was having put on the former hurriedly in the dark. Do you mind if I readjust?
Carry on, said Robin.
Strike rolled up his trouser leg and proceeded to remove the prosthesis. Ever since he had been forced to take 2 weeks off wearing it, the skin at the end of his stump had shown a tendency to object to renewed friction. Retrieving E45 cream from his holdall, he applied it liberally to the reddened skin.
Should have done this earlier, he said apologetically.
Deducing from the presence of Strike's holdall that he had come from Lorelei's, Robin found herself wondering whether he had been too pleasurably occupied to worry about his leg. She and Matthew had not had sex since their anniversary weekend.
"I'll leave it off for a bit," said Strike, heaving both prosthesis and holdall into the back of the Land Rover, which he now saw was empty but for a tartan flask and two plastic cups.
This was a disappointment. There had always been a carrier bag full of food on the previous occasions they had ventured out of London by car.
"No biscuits?"
"I thought you were trying to lose weight."
"Nothing eaten on a car journey counts. Any competent dietitian will tell you that."
Robin grinned. "Calories are bollocks, the Cormoran Strike diet."
"Hunger strike. Car journeys I have starved on."
"Well, you should have had breakfast," said Robin.
And to her own annoyance, she wondered for the second time whether he had been otherwise engaged.
"I did have breakfast. Now I want a biscuit."
"We can stop somewhere if you're hungry," said Robin. "We should have plenty of time."
As Robin accelerated smoothly to overtake a couple of dawdling cars, Strike was aware of an ease and restfulness that could not be entirely ascribed to the relief of removing his prosthesis, nor even of having escaped Lorelei's flat with its kitschy decor and its heart-sore occupant. The very fact that he had removed his leg while Robin drove and was not sitting with all muscles clenched was highly unusual. Not only had he had to work hard to overcome anxiety at being driven by other people,
in the aftermath of the explosion that had blown off his leg. He had a secret but deep-rooted aversion to women drivers, a prejudice he ascribed largely to early, nerve-wracking experiences with all his female relatives. Yet it was not merely a prosaic appreciation of her competence that had caused that sudden lifting of the heart when he had seen her driving towards him this morning. Now, watching the road, he experienced a spasm of memory, sharp with both pleasure and pain. His nostrils seemed to be full again with the smell of white roses, as he held her on the stairs at her wedding, and he felt her mouth beneath his, in the hot fog of a hospital car park. "Could you pass me my sunglasses?" asked Robin. "In my bag there." He handed them over.
"Want a tea?"
"I'll wait," said Robin. "You carry on." He reached into the back for the thermos and poured himself a plastic cupful. The tea was exactly as he liked it.
"I asked Izzy about Chisel's will last night," Strike told Robin.
"Did he leave a lot?" asked Robin, remembering the shabby interior of the house in Ebury Street.
"Much less than you might have thought," said Strike, taking out the notebook in which he had jotted everything Izzy had told him. "Oliver was right. The Chisels are on their uppers. In a relative sense, obviously," he added. "Apparently Chisel's father spent most of the capital on women and horses. Chisel had a very messy divorce from Lady Patricia. Her family was wealthy and could afford better lawyers. Izzy and her sister are all right for cash through their mother's family. There's a trust fund, which explains Izzy's smart flat in Chelsea. Raphael's mother walked away with hefty child support, which seems to have nearly cleaned Chisel out. After that, he plunged the little he had left into some risky equities advised by his stockbroker son-in-law. Torx feels pretty bad about that, apparently. Izzy would rather we didn't mention it today. The 2008 crash virtually wiped Chisel out. He tried to do some planning against death duties. Shortly after he lost most of his cash, some valuable family heirlooms and Chisel House itself were made over to the eldest grandson.
Pringle, said Robin.
What?
Pringle. That's what they call the eldest grandson. Fizzy's got three children, Robin explained. Izzy was always banging on about them. Pringle, Flopsy, and Pong.
Jesus Christ, muttered Strike. It's like interviewing the Teletubbies.
Robin laughed.
And otherwise, Chisel seems to have been hoping he could put himself right by selling off land around Chisel House and objects of less sentimental value. The house in Ebury Street's been remortgaged.
So Kinvara and all her horses are living in her step-grandson's house, said Robin, changing upper gear to overtake a lorry.
Yeah, Chisel left a letter of wishes with his will, asking that Kinvara has the right to remain in the house lifelong or until she remarries. How old's this Pringle?
About 10, I think.
Well, it'll be interesting to see whether the family honour Chisel's request, given that one of them thinks Kinvara killed him. Mind you, it's a moot point whether she'll have enough money to keep the place running from what Izzy told me last night. Izzy and her sister were each left 50 grand, and the grandchildren get 10 grand apiece, and there's hardly enough cash to honour those bequests. That leaves Kinvara with what's left from the house in Ebury Street once it's sold off, and all other personal effects, minus the valuable stuff that was already put into the grandson's name. Basically, he's leaving her with a junk that wasn't worth selling, and any personal gifts he gave her during the marriage.
And Raphael gets nothing?
I wouldn't feel too sorry for him. According to Izzy, his glamorous mother's made a career out of asset-stripping wealthy men. He's in line to inherit a flat in Chelsea from her. So, all in all, it's hard to make a case for Chisel being killed for his money, said Strike. What is the other sister's bloody name? I'm not calling her Fizzy.
Sophia, said Robin, amused.
Right, well, we can rule her out. I've checked. She was taking a riding for the disabled lesson in Northumberland on the morning he died. Raphael had nothing to gain from his father's death, and Izzy thinks he knew it, although we'll need to check that.
Izzy herself got what she called a bit squiffy at Lancaster House and felt a bit fragile the following day. Her neighbour can vouch for the fact that she was having tea in the shared courtyard behind their flats at the time of death. She told me that quite naturally last night.
Which leaves Kinvara, said Robin.
Right. Now, if Chisel didn't trust her with the information that he'd called in a private detective, he might not have been honest about the state of the family finances either. It's possible she thought she was going to get a lot more than she has, but
she's got the best alibi in the family, said Robin.
Exactly, said Strike.
They had now left behind the clearly man-made border shrubs and bushes that had lined the motorway as it passed Windsor and Maidenhead. There were real old trees left and right now, trees that had predated the road and which would have seen their fellows felled to make way for it.
Barclay's call was interesting, Strike went on, turning a couple of pages in his notebook. Knight's been in a nasty mood ever since Chisel died, though he hasn't told Barclay why. On Wednesday night he was goading Flick, apparently. Said he agreed with her ex-flatmate that Flick had bourgeois instincts. Do you mind if I smoke? I'll wind down the window.
The breeze was bracing, though it made his tired eyes water. Holding his burning cigarette out of the car between drags, he went on.
So Flick got really angry, said she'd been doing that shitty job for you, and then said it wasn't her fault they hadn't got 40 grand, at which Jimmy went, to quote Barclay, apeshit. Flick stormed out, and on Thursday morning, Jimmy texted Barclay and told him he was going back to where he grew up, to visit his brother.
Billy's in Woolston, said Robin, startled.
She realized that she had come to think of the younger Knight brother as an almost mythical person.
Jimmy might have been using him as a cover story. Who knows where he's really got to? Anyway, Jimmy and Flick reappeared last night in the pub, all smiles. Barclay said they'd obviously made up over the phone, and in the 2 days he was away, she's managed to find herself a nice non-bourgeois job.
That was good going, said Robin.
How do you feel about shop work?
I did a bit in my teens, said Robin. Why?
Flick's got herself a few hours part-time in a jewellery shop in Camden. She told Barclay it's run by some mad Wiccan woman. It's minimum wage, and the boss sounds barking mad, so they're having trouble finding anyone else.
Don't you think they might recognise me?
The night lot have never seen you in person, said Strike. If you did something drastic with your hair, broke out the coloured contact lenses again. I've got a feeling, he said, drawing deeply on his cigarette, that Flick's hiding a lot.
How did she know what Chisel's blackmailable offence was?
She was the one who told Jimmy, don't forget, which is strange.
Wait, said Robin. What?
Yeah, she said, when I was following them on the march, said Strike. Didn't I tell you?
No, said Robin.
As she said it, Strike remembered that he had spent the week after the march at Lorelei's with his leg up, when he had still been so angry at Robin for refusing to work that he had barely spoken to her. Then they had met at the hospital, and he had been far too distracted and worried to pass on information in his usual methodical fashion.
Sorry, he said. It was that week after...
Yes, she said, cutting him off.
She too preferred not to think about the weekend of the march.
So what exactly did she say?
That he wouldn't know what Chisel had done but for her.
That's weird, said Robin, seeing as he's the one who grew up right beside them.
But the thing they were blackmailing him about only happened 6 years ago, after Jimmy had left home, Strike reminded her. If you ask me, Jimmy's been keeping Flick around because she knows too much. He might be scared of ending it, in case she starts talking. If you can't get anything useful out of her, you can pretend selling earrings isn't for you and leave. But the state their relationship's in, I think Flick might be in the mood to confide in a friendly stranger. Don't forget, he said, throwing the end of his cigarette out of the window and winding it back up. She's also Jimmy's alibi for the time of death.
Excited about the prospect of going back undercover, Robin said,
I hadn't forgotten. She wondered how Matthew would react if she shaved the sides of her head or dyed her hair blue. He had not put up much of a show of resentment at her spending Saturday with Strike. Her long days of effective house arrest and her sympathy about the argument with Tom seemed to have bought her credit. Shortly after 10:30, they turned off the motorway onto a country road that wound down into the valley where the tiny village of Woolston lay nestled. Robin parked beside a hedgerow full of traveller's joy so that Strike could reattach his prosthesis. Replacing her sunglasses in her handbag, Robin noticed 2 texts from Matthew. They had arrived 2 hours earlier, but the alert of her mobile must have been drowned out by the racket of the Land Rover. The first read, "All day, what about Tom?" The second, which had been sent 10 minutes later, said, "Ignore last, was meant for work." Robin was rereading these when Strike said, "Shit." He had already reattached his prosthesis and was staring through his window at something she could not see. "What?"
"Look at that."
Strike pointed back up the hill down which they had just driven. Robin ducked her head so that she could see what had caught his attention. A gigantic prehistoric white chalk figure had been cut into the hillside. To Robin, it resembled a stylized leopard, but the realization of what it was supposed to be had already hit her when Strike said,
"Up by the horse." He strangled the kid up by the horse.
Chapter 42. In a family there is always something or other going awry. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. A flaking wooden sign marked the turning to Chisel House. The drive, which was overgrown and full of potholes, was bordered on the left by a dense patch of woodland, and on the right by a long field that had been separated into paddocks by electric fences and contained a number of horses. As the Land Rover lurched and rumbled towards the out-of-sight house, 2 of the largest horses, spooked by the noisy and unfamiliar car, took off. A chain reaction then occurred, as most of their companions began to canter around too, the original pair kicking out at each other as they went.
"Wow,"
said Robin, watching the horses as the Land Rover swayed over the uneven ground.
"She's got stallions in together."
"That's bad, is it?" asked Strike,
as a hairy creature the colour of jet lashed out with teeth and back legs at an equally large animal he would have categorised as brown, though doubtless the coat colour had some rarefied equine name.
"It's not usually done," said Robin, wincing, as the black stallion's rear legs made contact with its companion's flank.
They turned a corner and saw a plain-faced neoclassical house of dirty yellow stone. The gravelled forecourt, like the drive, had several potholes and was strewn with weeds. The windows were grubby, and a large tub of horse feed sat incongruously beside the front door. 3 cars were already sitting there, a red Audi Q3, a racing green Range Rover, and an old and muddy Grand Vitara. To the right of the house lay a stable block, and to the left a wide croquet lawn that had long since been given over to the daisies. More dense woodland lay beyond. As Robin braked, an overweight black Labrador and a rough-coated terrier came shooting out of the front door, both barking. The Labrador seemed keen to make friends, but the Norfolk Terrier, which had a face like a malevolent monkey, barked and growled until a fair-haired man, dressed in stripy shirt and mustard-coloured corduroy trousers, appeared at the doorway and bellowed,
"Shut up, Rattenbury!"
Cowed, the dog subsided into low growls, all directed at Strike.
"Torquil Damery," drawled the fair-haired man, approaching Strike with his hand outstretched.
There were deep pockets beneath his pale blue eyes, and his shiny pink face looked as though it never needed a razor.
"Ignore the dog. He's a bloody menace."
"Cormoran Strike, this is..."
Robin had just held out her hand, when Kinvara erupted out of the house, wearing old jodhpurs and a washed-out T-shirt, her loose red hair falling everywhere.
"For God's sake, don't you know anything about horses?"
she shrieked at Strike and Robin.
"Why did you come up the drive so fast?"
"You should wear a hard hat if you're going in there, Kinvara," Torquil called at her retreating figure. But she stormed away, giving no sign that she had heard him.
"Not your fault," he assured Strike and Robin, rolling his eyes. "Got to take the drive at speed or you'll get stuck in one of those bloody holes. Come on in. Ah, here's Izzy."
Izzy emerged from the house, wearing a navy shirt dress, the sapphire cross still around her neck. To Robin's slight surprise, she embraced Strike as though he was an old friend come to offer condolences.
"Hi, Izzy," he said,
taking half a step backwards to extricate himself from the embrace.
"You know Robin, obviously."
"Oh, yeah, got to get used to calling you Robin now,"
said Izzy, smiling and kissing Robin on both cheeks.
"Sorry if I slip out and call you Venetia. I'm bound to. That's how I still think of you." "Did you hear about the winds?"
she asked, in almost the same breath. They nodded.
"Horrible, horrible little man," said Izzy. "I'm delighted Della's given him the push. Anyway, come along in. Where's Kinvara?"
she asked her brother-in-law, as she led them into the house, which seemed gloomy after the brightness outside.
"Bloody horses are upset again,"
said Torquil, over the renewed barking of the Norfolk Terrier.
"No, fuck off, Rattenbury. You're staying outside."
He banged the front door closed on the terrier, which began to whine and scratch at it instead. The Labrador padded quietly in Izzy's wake as she led them through a dingy hallway with wide stone stairs into a drawing room on the right. Long windows faced out over the croquet lawn and the woods. As they entered, three white blonde children raced through the overgrown grass outside with raucous cries, then passed out of sight. There was nothing of modernity about them. In their dress and their hairstyles, they might have walked straight out of the 1940s.
"They're Torquil and Fizzes," said Izzy fondly.
"Guilty as charged," said Torquil proudly. "My wife's upstairs. I'll go and get her."
As Robin turned away from the window, she caught a whiff of a strong, heady scent that gave her an unaccountable feeling of tension until she spotted the vase of stargazer lilies standing on a table behind a sofa. They matched the faded curtains, once scarlet and now a washed-out pale rose, and the frayed fabric on the walls, where two patches of darker crimson showed that pictures had been removed. Everything was threadbare and worn. Over the mantelpiece hung one of the few remaining paintings, which showed a stabled horse with a splashy brown and white coat, its nose touching a starkly white foal, curled in the straw. Beneath this painting, and standing so quietly that they had not immediately noticed him, was Raphael. With his back to the empty grate, hands in the pockets of his jeans, he appeared more Italian than ever in this very English room, with its faded tapestry cushions, its gardening books piled in a heap on a small table, and its chipped chinoiserie lamps.
"Hi, Raph," said Robin.
"Hello, Robin," he said, unsmiling.
"This is Cormoran Strike, Raph,"
said Izzy. Raphael didn't move, so Strike walked over to him to shake hands, which Raphael did reluctantly, returning his hand to his jeans immediately afterwards.
"Yeah, so Fizz and I were just talking about Wynne," said Izzy,
who seemed greatly preoccupied with the news of the Wynne split.
"We just hope to God he's going to keep his mouth shut, because now Papa's gone, he can say whatever he likes about him and get away with it, can't he?"
"You've got the goods on Wynne if he tries," Strike reminded her.
She cast him a look of glowing gratitude.
"You're right, of course, and we wouldn't have that if it weren't for you, and Venetia, Robin, I mean," she added, as an afterthought.
"Torx, I'm downstairs,"
bellowed a woman from just outside the room, and a woman who was unmistakably Izzy's sister backed into the room carrying a laden tray. She was older, heavily freckled and weather-beaten, her blonde hair streaked with silver, and she wore a striped shirt very like her husband's, though she had twinned hers with pearls.
"Torx,"
she bellowed at the ceiling, making Robin jump.
"I'm down here."
She set the tray with a clatter on the needlepoint ottoman that stood in front of Raff and the fireplace.
"Hi, I'm Fizzy. Where's Kinvaragorn?"
"Faffing around with the horses," said Izzy, edging around the sofa and sitting down. "Excuse not to be here, I expect. Grab a pew, you two."
Strike and Robin took two sagging armchairs that stood side by side at right angles to the sofa. The springs beneath them seemed to have worn out decades ago. Robin felt Raphael's eyes on her.
"Izzy tells me you know Charlie Campbell,"
Fizzy said to Strike, pouring everybody tea.
"That's right," said Strike. "Lucky man," said Torquil, who had just re-entered the room.
Strike gave no sign he had heard this.
"Did you ever meet Jaunty Peters?" Fizzy continued. "Friend of the Campbells? He had something to do with the police. No, Badger, these aren't for you. Torx, what did Jaunty Peters do?"
"Magistrate," said Torquil promptly.
"Yeah, of course," said Fizzy. "Magistrate. Did you ever meet Jaunty, Cormoran?"
"No," said Strike. "Afraid not."
"He was married to what's her name, lovely girl, Annabel. Did masses for Save the Children, got her CBE last year, so well deserved. Oh, but if you knew the Campbells, you must have met Rory Moncrief."
"Don't think so," said Strike patiently, wondering what Fizzy would have said if he told her that the Campbells had kept him as far from their friends and family as was possible.
Perhaps she was equal even to that.
"Oh, but then you must have run across Basil Plumley. They loathed him. Yah, violent alcoholic, but his wife did climb Kilimanjaro for Dog's Trust."
Torquil pushed the fat Labrador away from the biscuits, and it ambled away into a corner, where it flopped down for a doze. Fizzy sat down between her husband and Izzy on the sofa.
"I don't know whether Kinvara's intended to come back," said Izzy. "We might as well get started."
Strike asked whether the family had heard any more about the progress of the police investigation. There was a tiny pause, during which the distant shrieks of children echoed across the overgrown lawn.
"We don't know much more than I've already told you," said Izzy. "Though I think we all get the sense, don't we?"
She appealed to the other family members.
"That the police think it's suicide. On the other hand, they clearly feel they have to investigate thoroughly."
"That's because of who he was, Iz," Torquil interrupted. "Minister of the Crown, obviously they're going to look into it more deeply than they would for the bloke in the street. You should know, Cormoran," he said portentously, adjusting his substantial weight on the sofa. "Sorry, girls, but I'm going to say it personally. I think it was suicide." "I understand, of course I do, that that's a hard thought to bear. And don't think I'm not happy you have been brought in," he assured Strike. "If it puts the girls' minds at rest, that's all to the good. But the male contingent of the family, Raff, think there's nothing more to it than, well, my father-in-law felt he couldn't go on. Happens. Not in his right mind, clearly, Raff?" repeated Torquil.
Raphael did not seem to relish the implicit order. Ignoring his brother-in-law, he addressed Strike directly.
"My father was acting strangely in the last couple of weeks. I didn't understand why at the time. Nobody had told me he was being blackmailed." "We're not going into that," said Torquil quickly. "We agreed. Family decision."
Izzy said anxiously,
"Cormoran, I know you wanted to know what Papa was being blackmailed about."
"Jasper broke no law," said Torquil firmly, "and that's the end of it. I'm sure you're discreet," he said to Strike, "but these things get out. They always do. We don't want the papers crawling all over us again. We're agreed, aren't we?" he demanded of his wife.
"I suppose so," said Fizzy, who seemed conflicted. "No, of course, we don't want it all over the papers. But Jimmy Knight had good reason to wish Papa harm, Torx, and I think it's important Cormoran knows that at least. You know he was here, in Woolston, this week."
"No," said Torquil. "I didn't."
"Yeah, Mrs. Ankill saw him," said Fizzy. "He asked her whether she'd seen his brother."
"Poor little Billy," said Izzy vaguely. "He wasn't right." "Well, you wouldn't be, would you, if he were brought up by Jack O'Kent? Papa was out with the dogs one night years ago," she told Strike and Robin, and he saw Jack kicking Billy, literally kicking him, all around their garden. The boy was naked. When he saw Papa, Jack had Kent stopped, of course. The idea